Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Today, I'm proud to bring you Living Hermeticism with Frater Serpentis Satori. Greetings and welcome, Satori. How are you?
All right.
I'm glad to hear that. How are things in Chicago?
Better than Texas.
Okay. We've had a long and winding conversation about hermeticism, about life, about metaphysics, about all sorts of topics. Where would you like our journey to take us today?
Because we just went through the Mardi Gras that never was, because all of New Orleans was closed for all of Mardi Gras and there were no parades, and because I've been sort of soaking in the pop culture of New Orleans, we should talk about New Orleans and voodoo and vampires and popular culture.
Sounds like a plan to me. I'm game. So the floor is yours.
Well, it's very interesting watching our recent popular culture about New Orleans and voodoo going from American Gods and True Blood and even Supernatural,
mm-hmm.
How voodoo is being depicted in popular culture right now.
And it's even in Neil Gaiman's Dream series in D.C. One of their comics that introduced a new house of mystery type of thing is all about the voodoo and the Haitian Loas.
Well, they were there in American Gods, and American Gods actually does a very fair depiction of voodoo without much of the racist context it's usually put in.
Hmm.
It is interesting that in almost all of the stories right now, you go to New Orleans and you use voodoo for resurrection. Because that's how it's used in American Gods. That's how it's used in Preacher.
That's some of the great series.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that they, both of those series take similar tacks with, if you need someone brought back from the dead, you have to use African magic and voodoo.
Is that because culturally we have the lore of the zombies entered our popular culture fairly early and became a staple of movies, and zombies were for
the lore enters us with the Penny Dreadfuls, and then
okay.
There's the Bela Lugosi white zombie movie, which is really early on, and there's some stuff in silent films too.
Okay.
But you know, there's also Marie Laveau has her own song.
Yeah.
There's a song about Marie Laveau that's actually the very beginning of a Tremé episode, which if you really love New Orleans, you really need to see Tremé, because Tremé is really New Orleans cultural studies for those of you who have never lived there. It explains all of our weird New Orleans words, all of our weird New Orleans customs, what a king cake is, what Lagniappe is, all of that stuff is explained in Tremé. All the other shows just sort of drive through New Orleans.
I missed Tremé. What is what type of show is Tremé, and how can one access it?
Tremé was HBO and is done by all of the same people who did The Wire, and
okay.
It's about New Orleans in the immediate aftermath of Katrina. So it's the first season is all about right after Katrina hit, and everybody trying to fix their houses and get on with their lives, even though that's almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also in the Boondocks. The Boondocks cartoon actually has a character from New Orleans at some point in Boondocks, and that is done very respectfully, too. But Treme is the if you say you love New Orleans, you need to watch Treme, because Treme explains New Orleans in a cultural way, not in the odd way the rest of pop culture has handled New Orleans.
Our earliest conversations when we first crossed paths were about the Afro-Caribbean syncretic spiritualities. And the role they play and the things that they can teach us about antiquity that basically no other system of study at that particular point in time was as rich in explaining things like how can Theseus have a divine parent and a mortal parent and other questions like that. So it's a very rich mythology and spirituality to explore, and it's very different than what most people expect if they only grew up with the fictive movies.
Well, because I live in a Puerto Rican neighborhood, one of the things I have to explain to my housemates is the color codes, because I'm like, no, you see it all the time, you just don't know you're seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going on all around you, you just don't know what it's about. That's why you sometimes get a mix between Have a Blessed Day and Happy Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't know what religion you are. That's why we have so many weird rum options at our liquor stores.
Now, you mentioned Happy Tuesday. In American Gods, Odin calls himself
Wednesday.
And, of course, Wednesday is Odin's day. Before then it was Mercury's day, and there are associations with Mercury and Odin, and it kind of points to the fact that the days of the week actually mean something, and there's a lot of lore attached to them.
Yeah, but that's also tied into the seven African powers and the seven African gods in Santeria,
mm-hmm.
because Santeria simplified their pantheon from the hundreds of Loa they have in Haiti, which is far more similar to our Olympic system, down to seven African powers. But Santeria probably is the largest Afro-Caribbean religion in America. I am quoted as saying that I think everybody in Los Angeles and Miami practices Santeria except for five or six Christians in each city.
Wow. That many?
Well, that isn't exactly what I originally said, but that's how it's been quoted back to me. And I'm like, well, I basically agree with that.
That's very interesting. Probably a lot of people don't know that the saint candles they find in dollar stores or in neighborhood groceries are ritually used in Santeria, also in Catholicism. But a lot of people practicing magic use those saint candles.
Right. Like, why is Santa Barbara so popular in Puerto Rican neighborhoods? Santa Barbara's not even a major saint. Santa Barbara's not even a major saint in Catholicism.
But her colors are red and white, and she's holding a sword, and she has a tower. So if you understand the symbolism of the gods, you can identify who that might be. And yes, that's who it is.
I mean, in New Orleans, they even have their own made-up saint. They have Saint Expedite, who has candles and medallions and is like treated like he's a real saint, but he's just the saint of expediting things. Where's my stimulus check, Saint Expedite?
Well, the same thing happened in Greece when Christianity took over, because you still have Saint Odysseus and Saint Hercules, and then Hercules got syncretized into Luke, the beloved physician, because at the time Hercules was the god of health spas, hot springs and gymnasiums. So he had a lot to do with healing around the time of the first century of the Common Era. So he became St. Luke as well. And this happened in countries throughout Europe where you could recognize the old quote-unquote pagan deities in their saintly guise. And they played a similar play.
Well, that was all the important pagan temples being taken over by St. Michael.
Yes. In between heaven and in the ancient way, heaven and the underworld sometimes changed management. So Hades is still Hades in Catholicism, but there are different people in charge of the realm. And heaven switched management to somewhere else rather than being Olympus. But in between the underworld and the world above, things pretty much stayed the same. And the lore of antiquity with the daemons and the angelic messengers and the cacodaemons, that more or less remained the same. And it remains the same to this day. And it plays out in our TV shows like you mentioned, Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Grimm. You know, this lore is pretty much the same as it was in antiquity.
And the things are still out there. It's just that most of us, that comment in Supernatural about how monsters kill off 10% to say is the same as wolves do of species they prey on.
Hmm.
That most people weren't paying attention when they said that in Supernatural, but that was an interesting little thing that they threw in that one episode.
It's interesting, too, that in Supernatural and also in science fiction shows where they eventually you get to know the Klingons, the Romulans, the Cardassians, you know, you get to know them a little bit better and they're no longer monstrous. The same thing happens in Supernatural, you know, that basically there are angels who are horrific and there are demons that aren't so bad. And so forth. And in the myths, too, it's not so much that there are classes of beings and it's all black and white. There are variations within the range of beings, with some being benevolent and some being malevolent in each of the categories. So everything becomes a grayness. And where do you draw the lines?
Well, Supernatural famously made Hecate the crossroads demon.
Yes.
They don't actually name her, but if you know Hecate, you realize what the crossroads demon says and does is supposed to be Hecate.
They also had Zeus.
But they're smart enough not to name her that. They're smart enough to sidestep that.
They also had Zeus, Cupid, Hermes, or
Osiris.
Yeah, they had Osiris. They had lots of different gods. And what was interesting in those god episodes, too, is they introduced something that, if you're involved with such things, is really something that you think about. I believe it was Kali claimed to the supernatural beings that came to fight them, they were part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that they were there first. And that's been echoed by other quote-unquote pagan deities in the Supernatural series. And again, it's a throwaway line, like you mentioned before, but if you know your stuff, you catch it. And it's like, yeah, this is something that really needs to be thought about. How do all these stories that we live blend with each other? And
Kali is portrayed in a very interesting way in American Gods, too, because she owns all those diners that are everywhere.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And that is done in a very interesting way, and her intolerance of Wednesday is done in a very interesting way too.
For Supernatural, my wife and I are now binge watching Supernatural. We're up to season 13 now. We just started season 13 the other day. With a pandemic and not wanting to pay for a million different subscription services, you know, we find that watching our old DVD collections something enjoyable. And I dug out some books I had on Supernatural also that dealt with the mythology, you know, both in literature and in the occult literature, you know, where a lot of the things that they're playing with came from. You kind of learn something new when you review, you know, all of this, and you see that this is something that's been going on forever too, that each, in terms of the stuff in the middle that these shows focus on, it's the loot of every culture, and each culture puts its stamp on it and gives it a particular slant or a particular, you know, variation. So the truths are preserved, but then so are the untruths. But they guide you if you're encountering such things. And they start you with some information on your adventure, your journey.
Right, because you begin by, a lot of people enter the occult path. If they're not trying to do a job spell or a love spell, they're doing it because they're having a trouble with a ghost or something like that.
And those things are common. A lot of people, as a culture, we dismiss them, and as a culture, we relegate them to a speculative type of shows or entertainment. But I've yet to give a lecture or a workshop anywhere where, even in libraries, where people in the room did not have personal experiences or experiences once removed where they happened to a very close friend or family member. And some things are frighteningly common, like encounters with shadows. I've yet to give a talk anywhere where a few people in the audience didn't stick around till afterwards and come up with their personal stories. And now those are coming out in the popular culture, but for a very long time, there was really nothing reliable on them.
Yeah, well, that was also part of things that happened after we had that interesting Shadow Assassin episode of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And all the weird ways they handle magic and religion in Game of Thrones. But making New Orleans the center of American occultism has always been interesting, because New Orleans witchcraft is very different from the Salem flavor or the San Francisco, Oakland flavor. But I guess that's because people always assume that, you know, all voodoo is evil. And if you practice voodoo, you do black magic rather than understand that it's just African magic, that it's just a very old contiguous tradition that didn't really get as messed up as the rest of the traditions did.
As you pointed out, I practice, in addition to all the Hellenic elements, I practice a form of American magic with the positive thinking and the creative visualization and the affirmations and law of attraction and, you know, all that type of stuff that arose in American culture. And even the theosophical, the neo-theosophical, more accurately, because theosophy came about during the Hellenistic era initially, and it was based on something that started to arise during the days when the Phoenicians were a maritime empire. But the neo-theosophy was born on this soil as well. So I've incorporated a lot of that into my private spirituality. And
all of those things have occult roots that go at least
to, yes,
that are at least as shallow as Barton, but also some of that stuff goes back to magnetic theory.
Mm-hmm.
That's early Victorianism, like early what becomes channeling, starts out as mediumship because Queen Victoria's husband dies. And that's where this all begins in the modern era.
Now, one of the things that's puzzling about the modern era, and this is something, again, because of my own particular training and path, is Blavatsky and the early theosophists were very stern in their warnings against spiritualism, even though they had spiritualist backgrounds and warned against psychism. Yet theosophy started to blossom when spiritualism merged with it. And
well,
now
that's also any sane practitioner is going to warn you not to play with Ouija boards.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're almost always talking to some first-level demon, some demon who's trying to lure you into doing something stupid.
I've always
and that's also, you know, that's lack of procedure. If you're dealing with spirits and you have lack of procedure, you have no idea what you're actually talking to.
Well, a lot of people argue, and this is something good to talk about, because people play too much with things that they don't quite have a background in or understand. But why is it dangerous to use a Ouija board? A lot of people argue that it's a game sold by game companies, so therefore it can't be that dangerous. It's something you could buy in the same place where you buy your other games like Risk or Monopoly.
You can't buy that so much anymore. They're very hard to come by at box stores these days.
But still, they are available. I remember when Toys R Us was open.
They are available, but they're much less available than they were even 10 years ago.
Okay.
And part of the danger is when you're using that in an unfocused way, if you're not banishing, if you're not using the proper incense and all of the proper training, you don't know what you're talking to. And that's
simple.
The danger. Well, you don't know what it is.
Right.
It might be a ghost.
Similar.
It might be a demon.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a malevolent fairy. It might be a benevolent fairy. You have no idea who you're talking to, and you have no way of proving who you're talking to.
It's very similar to if you've always been in a house and never went outdoors, going to the door and talking and then seeing who answers you. It might be, you know, a mass murderer. It might be a benevolent social work type person. It might be a next door neighbor, or it might be anybody. And you have no way of knowing and no way of telling because you have no experience outside the door.
Well, my coworker at the voodoo shop assumed that if you were using a Ouija board, you were talking to the spiritual equivalent of homeless people. That is the astral equivalent of homeless people because they can affect your reality because they're spirits, but it's not Archangel Michael you're talking to.
So how do
there are ways of doing that?
How do people develop that discernment?
You learn to banish. You learn to trust. This is where patronage is a good idea. This is when having a higher power who has a name and can guide you is very useful, because then if something gets out of hand, you can make the evil spirit go away through the power of your patron. That discernment comes through practice, and this is all the problems with like eighth grade kids playing with Ouija boards during a sleepover. You don't know what you're talking to, and there are reasons so many horror movies start that way. Because, for instance, in Haitian voodoo, if you want to talk to a specific spirit, you draw this symbolic thing called a veve. You make it out of corn, and you color it in certain ways. You offer it certain foods and alcohol. You light a candle and you start singing the song that summons that particular spirit.
Okay.
So only that spirit will show up. In the same way that if you're trying to contact a specific spirit, you use that spirit saint candle. If you're trying to talk to Santa Barbara, use a Santa Barbara candle. You have to be very careful when you're dealing with these unknown entities, because usually they cause trouble.
That is very true. Have I shared my cat story with you?
No.
Okay. I have a very long history of interacting with things that most people don't perceive, or perceive slightly. And so I've learned not to trust any whatever form something presents itself in. So when we were in Pennsylvania, we had a ghost cat. And this ghost cat, it looked solid, and when we had people coming over to stay for the weekend or for overnight, friends and family and so forth, they would always ask about the Siamese. So we would tell them, well, we have these cats that are living, and that cat is not, alive, but they saw it and they felt it brush against them. And, but I wasn't sure it was a cat. And it took me a couple of years to trust that it was actually, the ghost of a cat. And then I called it ghost. I gave it a name at that point, and we interacted with it. It didn't seem to be causing any harm. And one of our cats that we acquired, because, we were taking in cats, that were abandoned and so forth, that was pregnant, gave birth to kittens. And one of the kittens looked like a Siamese, even though they weren't Siamese cats. And I would call the kitten ghost. And before she learned how to walk, she'd like try to make her way to me. And also, she never behaved like a kitten. She behaved like an adult cat even when she was a kitten. And we still have her. She's still with us. She's very affectionate, but she's not like a regular cat. I took years before I trusted that it was something that I should be interacting with a great deal. But she made herself known for a couple of years before then. So that's just one example. We had some.
Yeah, well, there are lots of examples of entities that are around,
mm-hmm.
that unless you know someone who knows what they're dealing with when you're dealing with entities. Well, the most common example is a malevolent ghost and a gremlin can have almost the same effects on your reality.
Mm-hmm.
Only someone who can tell the difference between a gremlin and a bane can tell the difference. And normally it takes a little bit of work on the practitioner to realize which one it is. And sometimes you're in a really screwed up building that has both. Sometimes whatever negativity is in that building is feeding both groups of entities.
That is very true. And sometimes you'll never
Someone who can ghost bust just gets rid of the ghosts. The gremlins remain because you have to do completely different stuff to get rid of malevolent fairies. They're just going to laugh when you throw holy water all over the place. That's not going to bother them.
One of the problems that people have, and I've found this throughout my career in this particular area, is that it's hard to know what information that you're dealing with is accurate and which is not accurate. And also, there's so many scams going on in the psychic community as well, that a lot of people get burnt and then, don't trust.
Right.
So getting that discernment is something that's a very expensive education. And you find yourself, a lot of times where what you're doing isn't working or it's just making the situation worse. And sometimes, despite all you know, there are some things you'll never understand. I have one example in the same area where I got the ghost cat. We had at 3-4 in the morning singing. It sounded like singing children. up in the mountains. And again, we weren't the only ones who heard them. People staying over would sometimes get woken up by the singing children. And, you know, your brain tries to create a rational explanation, somebody's probably having a party and they're having kids, you know, staying over or something like that nearby. But when it's a blizzard outside and you're hearing singing at like 3-4 in the morning. So despite all the research that we did and all the things that we attempted, we never understood what that was all about. And we never figured out, how to do anything about it.
Well, it's probably echoes from some sort of ritual that was done in the old days.
Maybe.
Maybe by Native Americans, maybe by white people when they settled the area, but it's probably a place memory.
That is a distinct possibility. How would you recommend somebody who's interested in such things or has had a background some experience in these things, how would you suggest they go about safely? Because telling people not to do it, they're going to do it anyway. But how can they most safely proceed if you're like an absolute beginner? What would you suggest that people
do? If you're an absolute beginner, speaking of voodoo, and all of the African Diaspora traditions, your bathroom is your connection to death. However, that is understood in that particular flavor of Afro-Caribbean religion. And the normalized thing on all of those paths is to offer your morning coffee ancestors. So it's not... So the easiest thing and the safest thing, if you're not sure you believe, is to have a cup of coffee with grandma or grandpa every day.
Okay.
See what thoughts they put in your head. Light a tea light, make coffee, have breakfast, open your mind, and because you're not talking to their ghost. The soul moves on to reincarnation, but you leave your shadow behind. In almost all ancient traditions, that is very clear.
Yes.
After your body disintegrates, your shadow still remains by whatever technical term you want to use for it. When you are talking to grandma or grandpa or whichever of your ancestors you're talking to, you're not making them come back from the dead. That's the part of them that always remains in the world they lived in. That's their shadow. So it's easy enough to light a tea light every day and talk to your favorite dead uncle. Talk to grandma. And then you have someone on that side of the veil to keep an eye on you and keep those malevolent influences away of whatever nature if you're not ready to take the leap into having a patron and pantheon yet.
And that is something that people do anyway. They have pictures of their relatives and they often talk to the relatives that have passed, asking for guidance and advice. That's an impulse for a lot of people. So that is a safe place, a good place to begin.
It's a good safe place to begin. And most Catholics believe that grandma's their guardian angel anyway. So it's not against Christianity to do that, and it's the safest, easiest practice. And because of what the dead can do, they're able to affect the water pressure in reality. So it's easy for a shadow to help you get a car or a job or a girlfriend without doing black magic, just making grandma dinner every week.
And by making grandma dinner every week, what do you mean? Do you leave a portion aside for grandma, or is just you?
No. That's stupid neo-paganism.
Okay.
When you offer food to a spirit, you have to eat the spirit. You have to eat the food. That's communion. The whole thing about making food for a spirit and then throwing it out is part of why people that do that have bad luck.
Okay.
you've offered it to the spirit, and then you have not eaten it yourself. So the spirit doesn't know that the food is clean.
Can you elaborate
like if
that?
You do attend an Afro-Caribbean, no, if you do attend an Afro-Caribbean ritual, there's
okay.
a big deal about the line to get leftovers. Because you get leftovers in that culture based on your status within the community.
Okay.
So if you're a very honored guest, you get the first bag of leftovers. And then the chief, the big chief, and so on and so on and so on to get to the people who are yet to be initiated who end up taking home some rice and a chicken leg. But
so
no, you always eat the food. That's one of those Wiccan superstitions I've never understood about why you offer. Maybe it's because I'm a demigod and I would never throw away something I offered any of the Greek gods. I understand
okay.
they're supposed to get something, but because of what Prometheus did, we're allowed to, the gods get to eat the fat and the bone. That's what they get from our meals because that's very much part of our ancient tradition. But no,
so,
whatever your childhood comfort meal grandma made you, when you need something good to come into your life, make grandma the meal grandma made you when you got A's on your report card.
And then you would eat it and consume the whole thing and not leave anything or throw anything away.
Right.
Okay. So the vapors go to grandma.
The memory of it goes to grandma. The fact that
okay.
the fact that you consecrated it and offered it, because spirits don't really eat food. It's ridiculous to try to feed them. They eat candles and incense. They don't eat food. You're sharing the food with them. So in the place they are, they have the vapors and the energy and the love you put into the meal. That's another thing that caught me about True Blood. True Blood and Treme also both stop us at some point very early on and talk about bad mojo food, good mojo food. That bad mojo food is made out of jealousy and anger, and good mojo food is made out of love and caring for the community.
And that's an old.
I was really surprised that was in True Blood, but no. But the character who says that in True Blood, when we see his house, he's obviously a practitioner.
Okay.
Yeah, he has an altar in his house. He's obviously a practitioner.
To offer things to other people, if you offer them in ill, if they weren't prepared with goodwill and good intentions, rather than being nourishment, it could be poison. I remember growing up with that belief in the Greek culture.
It's a belief in all ancient cultures.
And you had to be careful of poisoned givers or resentful givers, as they were sometimes called, because they were
right. It's the same thought. Yeah, it's exactly
yeah.
what the character was saying in the show. Yeah.
And this tied in Greece with the whole evil eye thing, you know, where you know, basically if someone admired something that was good, but if they admired it with jealousy. Even if they made a positive statement, then that's something that could activate the evil eye and cause harm.
Yeah, an evil eye is just residue from all the charming stuff we know about ancient worlds and curse tablets. All of the books one can read about curse tablets and how that's demonstrated in the HBO Rome show. Rome actually gives us an episode where we see cursing in Rome.
Yes, I remember that episode.
Because I remember when that came out, people were like, it wasn't really like that. I'm like, there's a whole bookshelf of books you can read about that. That's pretty close.
Yeah, we're
just like the armor. They did a good job.
Yeah, they did. They did a really good job of historically showing some things that hadn't been shown before. So
like what Romans eat. Like what Romans eat wasn't done well before Rome. People had no idea that Romans mostly ate finger food.
Mm-hmm.
like I was explaining to one of my housemates about, like, you drank wine out of a bowl because you were dipping your meat in the wine in Rome. Because your meat was probably a little overcooked in Rome.
And you watered your wine as well. You didn't drink the wine straight as we do these days.
Right.
So basically, if someone has experiences or wants experiences with the world beyond, the best thing to do is to find someone you loved who's passed on, and basically cook them a meal, offer them your coffee in the morning. Here's to you, Grandma, when you drink your first cup in the morning. And if you have a religious figure that you trust is able to protect you, then you would approach that religious or spiritual figure first for some form of patronage so that you get protection. And then you avoid things that you don't, that don't seem kosher to you until you know more, until you know what you're able to do, or until you're communicating better with Grandma or with St. Michael, for instance.
Right, and in both those cases, both of those together can keep you away from the creepy stuff a Ouija board would attract.
Now, you had mentioned initiatic traditions and initiates. How does one, in addition to inner guidance and what they might have uncovered through research to see what the resonances they are, what else would you suggest should guide a person in choosing a group where they can receive training? How do you know what's a legit group as opposed to a bunch of people who read a few books and, you know, are playing with the recipes in them?
That takes a lot of getting to know the group and getting to know the people who are the leaders of the group and their personalities and backgrounds. Because every tradition in our country has gone through all of this ugliness about scams and sexual stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened in the Golden Dawn. It happened in Salem. It didn't happen in New Orleans because I was in New Orleans, and that was dealt with in a different way because the young white people all went native and all accepted Alegua heads from the voodoo people. So we all went native and we all accepted the local religion. So when there were problems going on in New Orleans, everybody who wanted the problems to go away made the problems go away together. So that did even happen in New Orleans. Most people just don't know about it because of how quickly that was dealt with. But you all know there were some vampires who were up to trouble in New Orleans in the 90s. Everybody knows that.
Yes, and there were a couple of books written about that, and they were true. It's like layers of the onion with the vampires. The deeper you go down, the more dangerous and creepy it becomes. But yeah, there is a vampire subculture, everything from the goths and TV show and Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game people, which are like the outermost layer of the onion, and then it gets darker and darker.
All the way up to people that are in federal prison because the FBI busted them for all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's something I came in contact with that many times in my life, and not for a while though. There's definitely something there in the middle of that.
Yeah, and that really happened too. That was just much more out of control in the 90s because the people who should have been dealing with it didn't. And then my generation came of age, and that was something we had to deal with immediately. And by the time we were done dealing with the real troublemakers, what was left, of course, ended up going to jail with the FBI. All that weird stuff in Florida and in the desert, all the weird vampire stuff right before the millennium.
And yet it still exists, the vampires. They're still there.
No, they're still there, but just like in Supernatural, they are few and far between. They weren't fought to total extinction. They were fought to, if you ever get this powerful again, this is going to happen again. Control yourselves and play by the rules. As long as all the supernatural beings play by the rules, the wizards don't have to do anything. It's when you step outside the rules or think you're going to make different rules and break the ancient agreements that things get out of hand.
One of my initiatives is the Temenos initiative. And again, I'm starting to introduce that a little bit on the podcast. But that's kind of like a redefinition of a community. And when I become active with that, I come in contact with other, I guess you can call them subcultures in our society. And we've had several of them, you know, on the show, representatives from them. Again, few and far between. There are incarnate others who are part of the human life stream that were at one point fairies or, you know, something else. And there's the practice of totemic shamanism, which is a highway to what in the lore survives as werewolves and werecats and, you know, all sorts of, you know, things like that. So for anybody who decides to take that path, and again, the shows teach you and mislead you at the same time. So the lore you're getting there is good but suspect in many areas because it's part of storytelling. They're there to tell you a story, not to educate you. Yes, there are things.
The shows are very useful if you're curious about these things, especially supernatural, because supernatural does start you out with a complete. One of the characters, although he was raised in the life, walked away, so we get it from his point of view for a long time about him coming back into this world, and all the weird stuff going on. That is going on all the time. We just don't see it because we don't know how. And we get the same explanation Supernatural get in Buffy about, like, oh, they see it. They just forget it 10 minutes later. But they see it.
Yeah,
just convince yourself you didn't.
That is very true. And there are spirits that can tell you, it's okay, go back to sleep. And you'll go back to sleep. And then if again, you experiment with such things, you'll wonder later, why did I listen to that? You know, why was that such an easy suggestion for them to give and for me to take? So the experiences don't take place totally on the physical. They cross into the etheric, the astral, the mental, in some cases the spiritual. So there's like the lines of what is real get blurred with those type of encounters.
That was one of the things that I thought that the voodoo people thought was so interesting about me and my coworker from the voodoo shop, because she and I both believe in fairies, but in a more conventional, traditional Irish sense,
mm-hmm.
which means they're not all good.
Right.
Much more like the way that's depicted in American Gods, because American Gods does a very good job in the episode about fairy lore and the girl who works with fairies. That episode is straight up about fairies, that they're not all good, and a lot of people who practice Santeria and voodoo don't acknowledge that fairies are real. So
right.
When they encountered us, and every once in a while we would like just throw glitter on people on Bourbon Street sometimes, but that was also back in the 90s when there actually were fairy conventions. There actually were conventions of people who would put on fairy wings and glitter and party all night.
That's still going on here in Jersey. There's fairy fairs and you know, all sorts of things still.
Mermaid things.
Yes, I was very involved with that for a while. In Greek culture, it's the same thing. The fairies are called taxotika, the exotics. And they're among the creatures that are between the heavens and the underworld that, again, have been here regardless of how many changes in administration you might have above and below. And there are many tales of them that if you can find a really scholarly book on Greek folklore, you'll find some of those tales. Otherwise, the tales you grew up with. So that's the supernatural that you were given by your culture to guide you through.
I was trying to explain to a friend of mine that Medea in most of Greece is sort of used as a generic fairy godmother figure.
Mm-hmm.
That Medea, however that connected to Jason, whether Jason was taped on later, however that all really worked. If you look at the folklore of Medea, Medea is used the same way that in Ireland it would be like a Disney fairy godmother Cinderella situation. That a boy is trying to fall in love with a girl, so Medea gives him a magic bracelet, and they fall in love, but then he loses the bracelet. It's all stuck. Tell you the names. I just told you the story. You would be like, oh yeah, that's the fairy godmother archetype. Like,
uh-huh.
Yeah, but in Greece they said it was Medea, and Medea gets away in her dragon chariot. The stories that remain, she has her dragon chariot and her dragon warriors and all the remaining stories. That never went away.
No, and Medea is still very active. Most recently, where I had my Golden Fleece group, one of the people was a channeler. And Medea made her presence known pretty early and remained throughout. So we honor Medea and her contributions to our Golden Fleece group. And in the lore that I grew up with, which is called mythology by most people, Medea made it to Elysium, whereas Jason did not.
Yeah.
And the story...
Jason, after the adventures, becomes kind of a jerky king character.
Yeah.
Even before the Euripides play, the stuff even before Euripides isn't very kind to Jason after the adventure.
And there are lessons in meditating that, you know, because here in our culture, we've glorified him and we've minimized Medea to, you know, almost meaninglessness. And in like the Sword and Sandal movies that I love, Medea, you know, is minimized greatly or left out completely.
Well, that's our general fear. That's the fear of witches, which becomes the fear of Hecate, which becomes the Macbeth thing about Hecate and turning Hecate into female Satan. When actually, if you go back and read the old books, it's very clear that Hecate has always been on humanity's side.
Yes.
Even when that means arguing with Zeus and Hera. Even when Zeus wants to destroy humanity, Hecate's like, but look at these pretty temples. Look at the view from this temple. They give us breakfast in this temple. Look at that view.
You should write a Greek mythology book. They give this more benevolent perception. The Wiccans also have a very odd, you know, they conflagrated Hecate with the triple goddess, identify her mostly with the crone aspect of the triple goddess. My experiences of Hecate is that she's young and vibrant. Those are my personal experiences of Hecate, and they've always have been since childhood.
So have mine. Mine have always been that Hecate is sort of a hot MILF who's wearing the one-piece red dress, who's trying to get you to go to the opera with her.
Battlestar Galactica, here we are. Okay. And The Matrix, too.
No. My Warden has Hecate as a blonde. In the Warden books, Hecate is blonde with long hair. Well, there's also the weird... You didn't get far enough into Penny Dreadful to get to Eva Green's weird speech about Hecate in the second season.
I saw them. I haven't seen them in a while, but we saw the first three seasons. I think that's all there was, right? And
That's all there is three seasons. Yeah, but there's that weird speech in like the third episode of the second season, because the villains in that season are the witches from Macbeth.
Okay.
And the youngest witch calls herself Aphrodite Hecate.
Okay.
And she lies about who Hecate is, and then Eva Green gives both answers that are the truth. The answer that Hecate is the goddess of witchcraft, yes, that's in Macbeth, but to the Romans, she's the goddess of storms and fertility. That is also true. I guess it depends on which test in England you're taking, because if you're taking the classical studies quiz, Hecate is the Roman goddess of storms, and her August holiday is so the fishermen bring home lots of good fish. If you're a more modern person or a more theatrical person or pop culture person, you believe you summon Hecate with toil and trouble.
And that's an excellent place to end our conversation. We have a couple of minutes left. Are you reachable directly yet, or should people contact?
No. I want to go through you as soon as we start setting everything up for how we're going to do the lower levels of Invictus and start structuralizing all that once we've got all of our curriculum nailed down.
Sounds like a plan, and hopefully the focus will remain.
I have to test that on my current body of students, go through how I want to see, because of how we're structuring things, I want to make sure that the way I'm doing basic magic works for people in this world, in the 20th century post-Trump, in this world, because I'm no longer in New Orleans in the 90s, and what worked then doesn't work now.
Right. Okay, I look forward to that. Satori, thank you very much. I always enjoy these conversations, whether they happen publicly online or privately on our cell phones. I look forward to our next conversation. Be well, my friend.
All right, talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, and thanks to all who've joined us, whether you've joined us live or you'll be joining us later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. We're going to end with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.